The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Gregor Moder teaches philosophy at the University of Ljubljana, and he is the author of the book Hegel and Spinoza. The original plan for this episode was for us to discuss his paper about street theater and Althusser, but we hit it off so well, so easily fell into philosophical conversation, that my prepared questions on his paper were simply pushed aside, and we just entertained each other with this sort of spontaneous conversation about Hegel and Spinoza, and of all things, Donald Trump. It's Wednesday, February 24th, 2015, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. In the United States, the reality TV show known as The Presidential Race is dominating our political imaginations, and the hollowness of it, the silliness and the unreality of this spectacle has proven to have its own mesmerizing power. Still, our aim at Zero Books will be to, as much as possible, think about and evaluate the problems that the spectacle is designed to distract us from. And having mentioned distractions, I should also point out that listeners to this podcast might want to take a look at the 8-Bit Philosophy YouTube channel. There's a video in the works there about Alfie Bound's book, Enjoying It, Candy Crush and Capitalism, as well as a fun video about Donald Trump and the end of politics. And that's online now. In this episode, you'll hear a clip from Mel Brooks' Hitler Rap, an excerpt from an old Diet Soap podcast wherein I describe Hegel's phenomenology to my son Benjamin and my wife Miriam, the music of Syriac, and Slavoj Žižek pontificating on Hegel. The music you're hearing right now is from Syriac's video Something, but in just a moment, you'll be listening to Gregor Moder and I discuss Hegel and Spinoza. So, tell me how to pronounce your name. What I usually do is I read the bio of the person. I kind of cobble together a bio for you, and then we take it from there. So, I'm going to say Gregor Moder, but that's probably wrong.
Well, doesn't really matter. Like the Slovenian pronunciation would be Gregor Moder. It should sound kind of like German. Like Gregor, how would you pronounce Gregor Samson from Kafka's book? Do you remember Kafka's book on Metamorphosis? There's Gregor Samson. How do you pronounce that?
Gregor Samson.
All right. Well, then, you know what? Then just the English
All right.
way.
All right. So Gregor Moder is a Slovenian philosopher and is faculty at the University of Ljubljana in the Department of Philosophy. He is the author of Hegel and Spinoza, Substance and Negativity.
Yeah, that's great. You can mention that it's forthcoming with Northwestern University Press. I've recently signed the contract finally, so you can mention that.
Okay. Well,
if that makes it more important,
you're mentioning that right now, so I'll leave that in. You are also the artistic director of the theater collective Robaf. Is that right?
Well, actually, I used to be. Yeah. I was the artistic director of this theater group for about 6 months, so you can drop that out.
Okay,
it's not a big portion of my CV. It's right. Just, I did work with this theater group or theater collective for about 10 years or so, and I still am at on some levels. So yeah, that is a big portion of what I did and what I do.
Okay, great. And you're also the author of this paper, What can Althusser teach us about street theater?
Right.
We'll talk about that a little bit today. So welcome to the Zero Books podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah. So one of the things I didn't mention in your bio, but I want to ask you about, is this fact that I found that you've studied comedy and negativity. Is that
right?
Fair? So what is this concept of negativity, and how does it relate to comedy?
All right. Well, that's a good question. The thing is with negativity that it's not – well, it's meant in a philosophical way. So it doesn't mean like bad temper or, you know, just bad feelings or whatever. It means negativity in a specific philosophical sense. Like there are things which are – which don't really exist. Like the depth, for instance. This is a good example, I think, for things that do not actually exist. You cannot touch them. They're not there in many ways, but they do define how you act, how society acts in general. So debt, like a bank debt or something like that, is a good example, I guess, of negativity in very everyday life experience. But there's negativity in more complicated senses as well that philosophy is very interested in. And I guess one of my points or one of my thesis, if I could use that term, was to claim that there are at least two general distinctions that one can make with regard to negativity in this philosophical or ontological sense, if you want to put it that way. And that is one way to see negativity would be to say that it's a kind of a curve, a kind of a curvature or torsion of being on some level. So that you know, if you're walking down the street, there are some sort of a torsion of the street. The street isn't straight. It's, you know, you kind of you know, there's a puddle maybe in the street or something like that.
Okay.
And the alternative would be that. The alternative would be something like a break, like a rupture in the texture of being. So something like walking in the street and then, you know, just falling down a cliff or something like that. So that would be two visual examples of how negativity in philosophy might be considered. And I'm trying to use that as a tool to explain how comedy procedures work. So there was a text I've written some time ago now, which tried to focus on three different concepts of negativity in philosophy that may or may not, well, I tried to make a case, like an argument in favor of this, that they can be also considered as three ways of how comedy functions, actually. So this would be my thesis on this part, I guess.
Well, can you give me an example of a negativity that's more like the puddle that maybe in the form of a joke?
Okay, so I was just making that puddle thing up, and I don't think it's a very good example. Let me just stick to the word torsion, and I'll give an example from Some Like It Hot, like the one of the best movies ever made, the Billy Wilder's 1959 film. There's a character that Jack Lemmon plays called First Geraldine, and then after a while she's called Daphne. Anyway, I guess you could say that what I want to say is that torsion would be the way how this character is his sexuality is perverted from male to female and back to male and back to female in a way that is really almost impossible to say. To see where, you know, there's no breaks in these transitions. So he's walking down. He seems to be going in a straight line, but turns to be, but finds himself on the other side. It's like, the Möbius strip is maybe a better example than the puddle.
I can see why you use the puddle analogy, because there's a subtle shift rather than a complete break. So you're still on the same terrain. That's
exactly
what you mean to say.
That's I guess what I wanted to say with that. There's continuity, but then there's a shift, there's a transformation, that takes place in a continuum and not as a kind of a rupture. So that would be the example of that. And in that paper I wrote a couple of years ago, I was arguing that you can use that as the example of torsion in philosophy, and the counterexample would be phallic jokes. Like that would be the Lacanian background of philosophical or psychoanalytic background of the concept of phallus, which doesn't exactly mean, as you know, like the male organ. It means rather a kind of the technical term would be something like a symbolic castration, which means precisely that rupture that we were discussing earlier. So an example of that kind of joke, I used a reference to another Hollywood movie. It's not quite as well known as Wilder's Some Like It Hot, but it's a fabulous movie. It's called To Be or Not to Be by Aaron Slubich. Do you know this movie?
I know Mel Brooks' version.
All right, Mel Brooks. All right. I haven't seen Mel Brooks' version, actually.
I saw the movie on HBO or on television when I was a child. So, but I don't recall. Yes, but go ahead. I think there was a disguise.
Yeah, there's a disguise. There's clearly a disguise, but there's a disguise also at play in Jack Lemmon's performance of Daphne. So the disguise is actually the same tool. What was really interesting with the beard, at least in the Lubitsch version, I'm not sure if that goes the same for Mel Brooks, is that this beard starts to function precisely as a signifier in this Lacanian sense, as something that you can detach or attach back on, and not just in the meaning of disguise of pretending to be someone else, but in the sense that this beard becomes an object that starts to function as the master signifier, in the sense that it structures everything around. So if you have the beard, then you hold the power. That's how one of the most fantastic scenes of the movie is played out. If the beard is attached, then I'm Hitler's best friend, and even though you are a colonel of the Gestapo, I overrank you in some way. But if you detach my beard, then I'm just a nobody. And the scene really uses this object, this fake beard, really well, and it's. And it's clearly a phallic object. So I would argue that this then is the case of, another example of how comedy works.
While you were describing the Jack Lemmon, you know, the Some Like It Hot example, I thought about the idea of transition. I thought of Hegel's critique of the idea of transition. It seemed like he would want to, he would say that there's always a conceptual break between one state and another, even if it, what seemed like a slow transition, a gradual process, actually involves a conceptual break.
Right. I'm actually very glad you brought Hegel up because this difference between torsion and a break is actually something that I've tried to describe or try to develop while working on my book on Hegel and Spinoza. So this would precisely capture actually the difference between, you know, like the core bottom line difference between the Hegelian dialectical approach, let's call it, and the Spinozist philosophy of, you know, of immanent causality, however you phrase it. So you know, like one of the simplest and clearest distinctions between Hegelian and the Spinozist system would be precisely on this, you know, on the way how transformation is considered. For Hegel, the transformation, just like you said, is always implies some kind of a rupture, like a huge break. Whereas for Spinoza, transformation is something that is always, you know, a kind of transition, as you put it. To just use your own words, this is how I would phrase it.
Yeah, and so that has political consequences that pop to mind immediately for me, which is if you believe in Some Like It Hot as the funniest movie, you might also believe in a reformist approach to overcoming, say, capitalism. Whereas if you are on the side of Mel Brooks, which is a distortion, I understand, but you would side with a more revolutionary break.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you spelled it out. I'm glad. I'm actually very glad that sometimes you can use philosophical concepts like torsion and lacuna or things like that, which seem to have no political implication of any sort, but they do. I mean, when you talk about, you know, this metaphysical abstract concepts, you know, many people would say, "Hey, but you know, what does that have to do with my everyday life? With you know, with the question of politics, with the question of, you know, capitalism, whatever. It doesn't have anything to do with it, but it does." And I'm glad how you spelled it out. Actually, I'm glad how you spelled it out. That actually, yes, actually, there is a very clear implication of the philosophical system to how this, you know, what kind of politics or what kind of political approach you are arguing for.
You've written this book, Hegel and Spinoza, Substance and Negativity.
Right.
Do you try to synthesize Hegel and Spinoza? Do you try to find commonalities between these two positions? Or are you making a case for one philosopher over the other?
Well, I guess my point would be to try to there's a book actually which has recently been translated into English by Pierre Machere, Althusser's student, and the book is called Hegel or Spinoza. And I think this book, Hegel or Spinoza, pretty much summons up the debate in contemporary philosophy or contemporary theory in general about precisely the thing that we have been talking about, whether we should all, you know, whether whether we should all focus on the Spinozist strategy or on the Hegelian strategy. So the core question would actually be the question of, are you in the Spinoza camp or are you in the Hegelian camp?
Yeah, that's what I'm asking you.
Yeah, exactly.
That's exactly the question I'm asking you.
Exactly.
So which side are you on?
So, well, I mean, that's precisely, I wrote the book called Hegel and Spinoza, because I'm trying to argue that Well, first of all, there's this alternative may be one of those false alternatives. I'm not going to say that, you know, if you are on either side, then you must be wrong somehow. I'm not going to make that strong right. statement, but I'm going to say that maybe we should consider that this is a false alternative. And I'm, you know, in the book, I'm going into the history of this debate. I'm describing the German idealism, which pretty much defined itself as, yes, Spinoza, he's a good guy. You need to start in philosophy as Spinoza, but then you have to, you know, you have to take off from that, let's call it foundation. You have to spring to actual philosophy. And you have a kind of a similar gesture in the French materialism of the 20th century with authors such as Althusser and Deleuze, who would argue precisely the other way around, who would say, Hegel, that's pretty much, you know, Hegel is someone who is the bad guy, and you need to approach the Spinozist perspective. So there seems to be some kind of a mirror situation where yes. where one side takes Hegel as their enemy, and the other side takes Spinoza as their enemy. But there is, of course, you know, as you know, if you just compare philosophers, of course, they have differences, they have similarities, but the argument that I'm trying to make is that you can actually talk about negativity in both of these philosophers. So even in Spinoza, which might be a very controversial point, but I am making that argument, and that is the common ground that is actually worth fighting for. And that these two concepts of negativity, one being torsion, the other one being the lacuna, the break, the whatever you want to phrase that part, is actually is a difference, but it's not, but maybe is not as important as it may sound, as the contemporary debates make it sound like. That's let's say that's my point on this way.
When you encounter someone who is, say, a student of Spinoza,
right.
are they open to this idea that you might find a way to find commonalities between Spinoza and Hegel?
Well, commonalities have never actually been a problem. I mean, there's even Machere pretty much claims that Spinoza's arguments against Descartes are very similar actually than to Hegel's arguments against Kant. So Spinoza versus Descartes is almost the same as Hegel versus Kant. When they talk about the method of scientific knowledge or something like that. So of course there are commonalities.
Let me raise the question.
Yeah, sorry.
Do you find that Spinoza's people are more open to the idea that these commonalities are more significant than their differences?
The Spinoza crowd seems to focus on completely different things. So they would never. Yeah, you're right. They would never basically underscore those commonalities. They would simply focus on things like affirmation and production of differences in this Deleuzian sense and so on. So yeah, that's like a generalization. And I think, you know, my point was precisely that maybe that part of the debate has, how does Hillary Clinton put it, has lived through its usefulness or something like that.
I don't know how Hillary Clinton puts anything.
And maybe the easiest way to kind of understand where we ended up is, Miriam, remember when Ben came to you and asked you how it was that he was himself and not someone else?
Yes.
One way to think about Hegel's phenomenology is that he's getting to this point where he's setting up a person or a subject as being this person who desires to know himself, the truth about himself. It's running up against problems all the time. So coming up to the point where in order to know himself, he has to know that he is not who he appears to be, as Ben was saying. It's like, why am I me and not somebody else? That whole question supposes that there's a person that Ben is, or a being that Ben is, that is not bound up in Ben.
Right.
But could be somebody else. And that's what a self-conscious being is looking to discover, is that
basically
ultimate
themselves there, what did it mean?
But yeah, but themselves apart from any part of the material or empirical
themselves world. Apart from themselves.
Yes. Yeah. The self that isn't
in this sense it's a reflexive determination. You are not just a series of your properties. You are that X, that void, you know. You are you means you cannot be reduced to your color, this, that, and so on and so on. In this sense, identity is already a redoubling of the thing. And to go a step further, identity always, for Hegel, involves basically, as what you hinted very nicely yesterday, a signifier. It's only a signifier which gives you identity.
Now we're coming to a point where, so what we just determined is this, that consciousness is actually the desire to know itself. It's this movement, we described it as a movement from a particular to universal and back again. In other words, it's this thing that exposes or defines differences.
Okay.
That's what consciousness is. And it does this in an attempt to know itself as it's moving towards self-consciousness. Consciousness is then defined by its desire. The way it enacts its desire is by taking the world and basically consuming it.
That reminds me of Secret Wars 2. The Beyonder is looking for desire, and he realizes that before he was human, he wasn't really anything. When he was everything, there wasn't much there.
Right.
And so he comes to Earth and looks for desire and tries to find out what desire is and experiences it for himself, and it kind of destroys him. And he winds up, like, almost trying to consume everything.
Think of me as one from beyond. Call me the Beyonder. My servant, known to you as Madam Web, and I are beings who can take many forms. We have traveled a long way and have seen many curiosities, but none as perplexing as a planet we stumbled upon called Earth. Our scrutiny has revealed much about humans that we don't understand. The most intriguing are your concepts of good and evil. I felt they warranted further study.
Listen, I'll just confess, I think you may have sensed this. I kind of fall on the side of Hegel over
right,
Spinoza.
I kind of sensed it, yeah.
But I'm not as educated as you are on these figures, so I have to go all the way back to my undergraduate days, which also unfortunately was probably much longer ago than yours. But here's how I think about Hegel and Spinoza, and this is maybe a bizarre way to think about it, and tell me how close to the truth I am here.
Okay. I will tell you how close to the truth you are, because I know all the truth.
Well, you're in the position of the one who, you know, university discourse here. You're the one who knows, and I'm the one being analyzed in the moment. I'm putting you in that position. Okay.
All right.
So my thought is that both Spinoza and Hegel are trying to overcome, and Hegel through Kant, but are trying to overcome this problem of subjectivity,
right?
Or how we can come to know the world, given that we are limited subjects, and that, as Hegel would say it at the beginning of the Phenomenology, that what we take to be, you know, certain through just something that's immediately present through our senses, we find is actually a product of our own imaginations or senses.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, it's essentially the problem of perception is for me central to understanding Spinoza and Hegel. But Spinoza's solution is to take the split between subject and object into a larger category to say, you know, the material world and the mental world, these are all just different ways that God manifests.
Mm-hmm.
And that they all should be included within that big circle of God.
Mm-hmm.
That all that is a manifestation of God. Okay. Now, this is very simple-minded approach, but this is how I see Spinoza. So Spinoza then, in a kind of in a legalistic way, you know, writes down all the implications of what it would mean if everything was God. And he's quite rigorous and interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Hegel says something different. He says, yes, that division between the subject and object is what is universal.
Mm-hmm.
That rupture is what defines reality. We can't get around that. We can't absorb fully the other into ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Precisely because it already is there. Precisely because.
All right. Yeah.
So now his what I just said to someone who hasn't read Hegel probably sounds just crazy, but I'm not sure if I can articulate it more clearly than that. But it comes down to this idea that that objectivity is a product of say the mental realm, that the material realm is something that is necessary for the mental realm to exist, but that it is absorbed by the mental realm, and at the very same time as it's defining the limits of the mental realm. So anyway, those are the differences between Spinoza and Hegel.
I'll just say it how I think is the most clearest way for myself. And I'm not saying that it's very clear for someone who studied philosophy in the United States, because it has something to do with the history of philosophy. So I hope I'm not going to be boring by mentioning these stories, which are of historical relevance. But I do think they are helpful in understanding this split, this Hegel-Spinoza split. So I would recall, you know, one of the basic phrases in German idealism, how they saw why Spinoza was even important for them, because Spinoza was someone who was a very heretical figure. He was someone who was absolutely hated by the let's call them the elite or the establishment or however you want to put it. He was someone who would
These religious elites.
Of course. Well, but religious elites did have still, you know, in the 17th, 18th century, they still in Europe, they hold sway. I mean, they defined, the terms of the debate, what was allowed to be said and what wasn't allowed to be said. And Spinoza had, you know, the double problem of being a Jew living in a Christian community, meaning that, you know, if you want to call someone an atheist and kill him, you know, he'd be the perfect target.
Right.
Because he was also excommunicated from the Jewish community itself, precisely because, you know, his concept of God was basically a non-transcendent deity. Basically, you know, he's known for his claim that Deus sive natura in Latin, meaning God that is nature, i.e. nature. So from this perspective, What happened that he was so interesting for German idealism? The thing is that there was this guy who was called Jacobi, this German who was a kind of a socialite. He wasn't such a huge thinker as he was someone who would, you know, talk to all the big shots of his time in Germany. And so at some point he claimed notoriously that in his private conversations, a prominent figure of German Enlightenment, Lessing, the famous Lessing, the author of many plays, declared himself a Spinozist, and this meant this meant war in some circles of German Enlightenment, because it meant like saying, oh, you're saying that Lessing was an atheist dog, and so this sparked a huge debate, an intellectual scandal, where everyone had to participate in, and the question at stake was was this. I mean, this is what Jacobi formulated, and it actually became the groundwork or the foundation of everything that German idealism had to say about Spinoza, and that was that Spinoza actually presents us with the perfect philosophical system, which is completely rational. There's no reference to anything irrational, to anything transcendental. Everything in Spinoza's system is a system of is almost mathematics. It's every step Spinoza makes is like a mathematical process of demonstration. So Spinoza became to be some a figure of philosophy as a completely rational system, which is able to define knowledge without any kind of reference to faith. And this was something that that was very important for Jacobi himself, because he believed that in the end, in the final instance, one does need recourse to faith if one wants to claim knowledge. So one does need the leap of faith in order to be able to say that one knows something. So any kind of knowledge, this is Jacobi's claim. Any kind of knowledge in the final analysis needs a kind of acknowledgement of faith in the Lord, of course. you could say that the German idealism, meaning everybody like Kant, Fichte, Schelling, Hegel, German idealism is basically trying to negate this Jacobi's proposition. The entire German idealism could be seen as an attempt to justify knowledge without any kind of reference to faith. So to stick to what Spinoza supposedly was able to do, namely to find a foundation for knowledge within the knowledge itself. That knowledge does not need any kind of outside guarantee that what it knows is true. And German idealism tried to say that, Spinoza is basically correct in assuming that, that there's no need to recourse on faith. However, what Spinoza lacked was the freedom of the subject. This is something that that his system of philosophy failed to account for, the freedom of the subject. So in the end, this is why in Hegel you'll find the famous formula of seeing the truth or the absolute or however you want to put it, not only as a substance but also as subject. So the German idealism would claim that Spinoza is precisely not able to talk about the freedom of the subject, that his mathematical, fully rational system is fabulous, is really good. However, it becomes a kind of determinism. It's rigid in its formation. Is a kind of deterministic system where you cannot talk about the freedom of the subject. And what German idealism tries to do is to stick to Spinozism in this mathematical rigor, but at the same time try to argue for the freedom of the subject. So. I know this is a long story, but I am trying to point out that it's not so easy to talk about subject in Spinoza, precisely because especially not with reference to Hegel, because for Hegel, subject is something that simply is not present in Spinoza's philosophy.
I'm remembering my college days here,
right.
and And what I recall is that this is the weird move I'm going to make. Right. I was very concerned back in my university days with not overcoming Descartes, but with overcoming Bishop George Berkeley.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, he was this immaterialist philosopher who thought that everything was just God's mind.
All right.
And so my problem was I believe Berkeley was right about matter, that he said matter was kind of an incoherent category, that it didn't make sense. And I followed his argument on that. But then when he moved to God as the guarantor of our perception, I thought God is has all the same problems that the bishop says that matter has.
Right.
And so
This is a fabulous point that you're making. It's great.
But what Spinoza did when I read Spinoza, and I read Spinoza after Berkeley, so for me Spinoza was coming along after Berkeley, even though the reality was the opposite.
Right.
So when I read Spinoza, I thought, oh, this guy has solved the problem. We're putting the material world and the mental world into the same overall category. But then what happened was I read Spinoza and I thought the trouble here is that Spinoza can't account for anything that is contingent, anything that isn't universal, anything particular.
Mm-hmm.
So at that – and I said, and obviously that has some corollary that in the kind of lateral thinking I was doing that's somehow correlated to, you know, the actual sense data of the world that really Spinoza can't explain our experience if he can't explain – the contingent, the particular, which is what we experience
right.
In our lives. I'm just kind of agreeing with everything you've said. Subjectivity is also strangely on the side of the particular and the contingent. But at least I'm going to make that wild claim.
I will certainly not disagree with you. I found actually your comment very valuable. I'll talk about the particularity in a moment. But first, I just wanted to say that I really liked how you phrased this difference between or the problem that arrived for Berkeley, namely the problem that okay, so you dismiss the naive materialism, but you end up in a kind of naive idealism, which has exactly the same kind of problems. And this, I think, is something that both Spinoza and Hegel saw through. So they both rejected naive materialism and naive idealism. This is maybe not something that's very obvious for Hegel. He's one of the German idealists, after all. However, he's not a naive idealist. He does not, Hegel is not someone who would say. Well, that, you know, like matter is simply unimportant or something like that. He just says that he would say something like idea is matter. I mean, this would be a Hegelian point that it doesn't really matter whether you are talking about, only substance or whether you're talking about only idea. It's one and the same thing, actually. And this is Spinoza's point exactly. I mean, Spinoza is notorious for claiming there is only one substance, which expresses itself both in the attribute of thinking and in the attribute of extension, which was a big deal for Descartes, who had two substances, the dualism of Descartes. So anyway, I just wanted to comment on that point was great. Now about the question of particularity in Spinoza, I would just say that you could actually see the other way around. You could also make the argument that everything in Spinoza is only the particular, is only the contingent. I mean, you could also make that argument. The point of it being that in the end, the problem would be of how to think. Let's call it the junction between the two, the junction between between something contingent or something completely particular and something universal. This is where problems arise for Spinozism, I think, in the general sense. So I would totally agree with you on this point. And I guess you could say that this is then what Hegel tries to do in his philosophy, is to try to think this point through, to try to argue how particularity transforms itself into universality, basically. This would be one way to declare what Hegelian project tries to do in general, tries to argue how the completely particular is transformed into something universal.
I took 2 years to read The Phenomenology of Spirit.
All right.
And what I did was I would read it, and then I would make a little podcast like this about it. And so I'd read a little bit and make a little podcast about what I read. And what I remember early days of reading The Phenomenology is that for me, one of the big revelations was to realize that every time you ended up with a particular idea, mm-hmm. or a particular experience, that what you were experiencing was always some sort of universal notion. Mm-hmm. And also then, once you've done that, it turns right around again that you're always experiencing a particular an embodiment of it. So like my simple example was a pencil. And if you look at a pencil, you see that, first of all, it's a pencil, which is itself a universal notion of a writing utensil as a definition, but it's a particular pencil. And then you can say that it's yellow. It's a yellow pencil with bite marks on it, say, and the eraser's half erased or gone. But then all of these concepts that everything about it that makes it particular are universal notions. Mm-hmm. But in order to be sensuous and present and in the world, they take on a particularity. Mm. So that was, for me, that was the Hegelian insight very early in the phenomenology.
To go beyond Hegel means paradoxically to discover a Hegelian dimension, like in modern art, modern abstract art, like in developed capitalism, to discover Hegelian dimension precisely in what Hegel wasn't able to grasp. Like, what Hegel not only was not this absolute narcissist in the sense of, oh, I see everywhere my own system. No, paradoxically, my point would have been that he wasn't enough of a narcissist, no? He didn't see, for example, how contemporary capitalism is more Hegelian sometimes than Hegel himself. Then there is the third point, which brings us, it's a very delicate point, to the true limit of Hegel, unfortunately. Social limit, but which has conceptual consequences. Namely, Hegel comes at that point where we have a passage from traditional society, master servitude, to modern bourgeois society of formal equality and freedom. And maybe precisely because he wasn't able to think capitalism properly, what Hegel couldn't have imagined, I think, is the basic paradox of capitalist societies, which is that you have formal legal equality, we are all free citizens, but that that relationship of domination reproduces itself precisely under the form of equality.
I remember, you know, trying to think Spinoza and Hegel for me was, you know, the distincting question for me was watching a football game. Can Spinoza enjoy a football game? That was the question for me that made the philosophical difference. Like, in the sense, if you believe in determinism, what, you know, if this is a truly determinist system, then, you know, what's the point of watching a football game? It's all predetermined in a way.
So if that's the case, so is your enjoyment of it. You know, whether or not you enjoy the football game is just...
Well, okay, right, that's true. Right, of course, that's true. But in a sense, I mean, wouldn't Spinoza in a way, you know, he'd be rooting for the team that wins, right? I mean, he won't be cheering for his home team. He would be cheering for the team that wins. I mean, that would be the Spinoza's perspective, you know? That would be the sub specie eternitatis, you know, trying to position yourself.
God would root for the team that wins, but Spinoza, being a mere contingent
exactly.
Just do whatever he was determined to do.
Exactly. You are totally correct. But that's what I mean. I mean, for Spinoza, you need to get to that perspective of God, right? I mean, you need to see things sub specie eternitatis. You need to see things in the perspective of eternity. Right? I mean, that's Spinoza's point. You need to see things from the perspective of eternity. And from the perspective of eternity, I mean, you know, the one who wins is the winning team. I mean, that's all there's to it, right? And for Hegel, I don't think that's really the case. For Hegel, you can actually cheer for a team. So that was my basic way of distinguishing between how they see the question of freedom.
As someone who's interested in Marx, I find that having some understanding of Hegel is useful. And so I find myself motivated to argue for Hegel against someone like Spinoza, so that we can get to Marx, you know, so we can go to the next step and say, look, this but where does the politics of Spinoza lead to, in terms of, if, let's say you're, let me ask you, you're kind of an anti-capitalist, I'm guessing.
Well, yeah.
Are you an anti-capitalist?
Well, who isn't? I mean, who isn't?
Donald Trump.
Well.
Donald Trump is not an anti-capitalist.
I don't think he's a relevant person. I mean.
Unfortunately, you may be incorrect, but yes. So you are. So what is the anti-capitalist position that comes out of Spinoza?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there are many Spinozist strategies, but, you know, the basic one for me is simply, you know, to go to what Althusser says about Spinoza. And he says that everything that Althusser says that everything he's ever written was basically basically already in Spinoza. There was only one thing that that Marx had and Spinoza didn't, and that was the concept of contradiction. That was the sole thing that he would miss in Spinoza. And of course, in the end, that is a Hegelian concept. That is something that you cannot find in Spinoza. There is no such thing as contradiction. Like, you know, if you you know, that would be like having mathematics and contradictions. It just doesn't make sense. At least not to 17th century mathematics. Basing on that, you could say that Althusser's critique of Hegel was also, a critique to a certain point. Althusser would criticize Hegel's concept of contradiction to a certain point. He would argue that it's too simple of a contradiction, but not that. You know, but as contradictions go, he would still require it. And now, to finally answer your question, where I would see that Spinoza can help us, within the anti-capitalist movement, the Spinoza strategy is a strategy of affirmativity. I mean, this is where every Spinozist philosopher or theorist or social theorist today would start from. If you want to organize yourself, you know, you have to do it in an affirmative way. So, and it does have a lot of relevance if you put it that way, actually. So you can't define yourself, well, basically you can't define yourself as anti-capitalist. I think that a proper Spinozist strategy, first of all, would be to say, no, I'm a civilized human being. That's it. And Trump isn't. That's it. I mean, he doesn't count because he's not a civilized human being. So it's not me who am anti-capitalist. I'm just a normal civilized person, whereas Donald Trump is a crazy anti-normality person. So he's the one who needs to defend his position. I don't. That's how I see, you know, the Spinozist drive. I kind of like it. Because you don't have also don't have to be atheist, for instance. You simply are a very normal, rational being. That's it. And it's not on you to argue, well, but how then can you argue for ethics? Well, it's very clear, actually. We need to help each other. We need to support each other. That's it. But you, who claim to be faithful, you are the one who needs to justify. Why is it that you need faith in order to be moral? I mean, that's how I see the that's where I see the value of Spinozism for, you know, the everyday anti-capitalist agenda, let's call it.
I just want to say, as a kind of a militant Marxist type, that you have to understand contradiction and rupture, and that. That we're not going to beat Trump based on some idea of normality or you know, continuity. Where that he represents a rupture that's actually really happening in society, and he's stepping in and giving it voice in an uncivilized way, and that the left's project should be to beat Trump at this game. And I would point to someone like Zizek as someone who understands this, you know, like this fascist move for strength and power and dominance. It isn't only on the right. The left has this as well. It's just our power comes from solidarity, and our power comes from true transformation rather than the sort of reactionary retreat into... I don't know what with Trump, but I guess some sort of tradition.
Well, tradition. As a Spinozist, I wouldn't use tradition for someone like Trump. But anyway, I would just call it authoritarian. Like I say, Mexico has to pay for the border, and then somehow that makes it true. I mean, that's just stupid.
Right, but the tradition that Trump is referring to is this massively. Is this destroyer of tradition, which is capitalism. So Trump is very contradictory himself, but I kind of have watched him. I mean, I'm closer to it than you are because I'm
don't forget that his wife is a Slovenian.
Okay, I won't forget that. But I'm watching his campaign in the United States. And it's being filtered through my teenage son to me, who he's not a Trump supporter, don't get me wrong, but who finds Trump to be endlessly amusing. And he'll show me these YouTube videos and things of that people have taken Trump and rearranged him. And he says that secretly he wants Trump to be the next president of the United States because it would be... Yes, it would be funny and fun. And that's the terrible appeal of Trump. That's
right.
What
he's funny. Crazy makes for a good television. That's a known fact, right? We don't want to see normal people on television. We want to see crazy people. That's a fact. And he's crazy, so he's good at it. I mean, that's it. That's true. And you know, to go back to the philosophical background of our discussion on Trump, I would say that Well, this is precisely where Spinoza fails, actually. I mean, and it goes back to what I was saying about enjoying a football game. Like, with Trump, he's clearly enjoying his game, right? And with Spinoza's perspective, you can't really beat him on this level. So you do need something like a Hegelian approach, which Zizek, of course, does have, which is to try to... you can also enjoy in this game. And this is something, this concept of theatricality, of performance, and so on, this is something that you can really think with Hegel's, with Hegelian tools, but also something that you cannot think with Spinoza's tools. Like, for instance, it is quite known that Spinoza's ethics is based on the concepts of joys and sorrows, right? I mean, he says that basically joys and sorrows are the basic like bricks of our experience. Every other experience is basically a combination of joys or sorrows, or a combination of joy with something else, and so on. So what I'm trying to get at is that while in Spinoza you can certainly talk about joys and sorrows, you cannot talk about tragedy and comedy. That's where the difference, where the importance of Hegel comes from. You can absolutely talk about comedy and tragedy and performativity and theatricality and enjoyment with Hegel or Lacan and so on, but you can't do it really with Spinoza. So I guess you are absolutely correct that when facing something like Donald Trump, you cannot beat him with Spinoza.